something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
So I was thinking about that song over the last couple of days. It seemed very timely, but particularly in the last 24 hours, there does feel like there's something happening, and it's not exactly clear what it is. So we decided we were going to go all old school by playing that. Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, joins us. Michael, you're old enough to remember that, right?
That was a great little memory walk there. I love it, man. I was thinking about a couple of tunes from Yes and the Grateful Dead, and oh yeah, good stuff.
All right, so when I first started thinking about it, I was thinking about that with the protest. Then yesterday, you know, we had the 1-2-3, and I want to get your perspective on this. You know, three remarkable things I thought happened in regards to the military. Number one, you have Secretary Mike Esper having this press conference where he explicitly says that he opposes using active military to deal with disorder, and very specifically says he opposes invoking the Insurrection Act. So that's a break with the White House. Donald Trump's very unhappy about it. That's number one. Number two, which I want to spend some time talking about, James Mattis finally breaks his silence, and he doesn't hold anything back, telling The Atlantic that Donald Trump poses a threat to the Constitution. And then you had that memorandum from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who reminds everybody that we are here to uphold the Constitution. People have the right to peacefully protest. And normally it would be sort of, I don't know, you know, anodyne. But in the context, it did seem that it was sending up kind of a signal to Donald Trump that, you know, you keep thinking that we're your military and we will do anything you want, but that's just not so. So give me your sense about it. Is the military pushing back? Did something happen yesterday?
Yeah, I think they are, and rightly so. And I think the defense secretary probably got an earful from folks that did not want to see the military used that way, felt boxed in, and did not want to have to play ball with Trump the way Trump was playing ball. And so, yeah, you saw this confluence of events just kind of emerge out of nowhere, where these folks who have great stature, who are well-regarded, current and former folks who have served in the administration, drawing a very clear line. And so I think when you're assessing this week, the president, you know, thought that it was all that in a bag of chips when he, you know, walked across the street with the Bible in his hand, you know, and professed, oh yeah, the pastors loved it. Well, no, that wasn't true. And now we find out that at least his Secretary of Defense and former secretaries are not happy with this either. And so I think it's setting a new tone. Look, the people are getting what's going on in the country right now. They have a better, clearer understanding of what's happening and what it may mean. We don't know exactly what it means or what it will mean in the future. We have hope that it may mean that there's a shift in how we look at these relations, neighbor to neighbor, community to community. But I think it's also a realization that there could be a shift in how we are assessing the leadership of this president. And the fact that polls now are showing that there's a huge and precipitous drop off, which is partly why the president, Charlie, has been reacting the way he has in his support, I think that's another indicator that there may be something afoot here in the country that will play out very interestingly over the next few months. And we'll see what that is and how this is all fully digested. But I think what we saw yesterday from the military, what we've seen from the religious community, and certainly now what we've seen from protesters who represent the voice of a lot of people in the country, that there's something going on here that I don't think Trump knows how to manage in his reality TV melodrama.
See, that's what my gut is telling me. I agree with you, but I put out a note on Slack saying, am I wrong to think that something is happening here that that I'm feeling like optimistic that people are getting it? And of course, I immediately got the pushback from my colleague Tim Miller, who says, "Never hope, Charlie. Never hope." I mean, we have been, you know, except for maybe the sweet meteor of death, that we've been here before. We keep thinking that this is going to be the turning point. I also thought that it sounded to me, it felt like the military was drawing a line, and we're getting these reports from the Pentagon that there was a lot of unease about this. Mike Esper really beclowned himself the other day when he referred to the cities as a battle zone. But you kind of wonder, is it a clear line? Will it actually hold? Is Mike Esper willing to resign? Is he willing to stand up to the president? I mean, how long does this happen? You know what I'm saying? I mean, we've been through this pattern before, so how much of it is real?
Yeah, and I think that's the assessment we're all making, and I think Tim is correct. We've been in this room before, and realized that there were still issues inside the room. So I think from that standpoint, you're exactly right. But I also think that the feel for this is very different, and at least right now, we've seen. Among the folks who've been protesting with the announcement that the three other officers have been charged, that they upcharged Mr. Mm-hmm. Coven, the central player in the killing of George Floyd, from third degree to second degree murder, which now goes from 20 years to 45 years on the high end of jail time. I think that energy is now sort of focused in a way that I think, coupled with what we saw happen at Holy Trinity or St. John's across the street from the White House, it's a different feel right now. And a lot of people are talking about it, Charlie. We're still trying to assess what it means and how it plays out. I don't know quite yet, what the politics of it may look like, but at least from the sense that as you look at these images of whites, blacks, Hispanics, Asian, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, all these communities are coming around this idea to begin, I hope, to fight for the idea of America that has been trashed over the last 3 years. And that to me is the test, I think, to see whether or not America passes it or fails it as it goes into November.
Yeah, this is difficult to sort of sort out the politics because we're living in this era of choose your narrative. What is your story? Are you focusing on the riots, the burning, or are you focusing on these remarkable scenes of the protest? The polls so far, though, are rather striking in showing that most Americans have sympathy for the protests, understand what is being protested and the seriousness of the problem, which is remarkable because I think there are some folks who just figured you're going to play the playbook from 1968, turn this into just simply law and order, and that there would be a huge backlash. Now, that may happen. That may come. But at the moment, there does appear to be a willingness to recognize, you know, something's terribly wrong when a man who's not resisting is essentially murdered by a police officer in broad daylight with witnesses, who keeps his knee on his neck for more than 8 minutes. That shocked the conscience of the country. So you do feel that there's a moment where people are willing to embrace these kinds of things. And I think that to that extent, Trump is very tone deaf to this moment.
He is, particularly when he leads the moment off with the tweet that references a 1960s, racial battle cry. When the looting starts, the shooting starts, and then follows that up with law and order. I can tell you, Charlie, that in my community, when we hear law and order, what that told us and still tells us is you better get your behind inside somewhere because some stuff is about to go down that's not good. And so we see, this idea that this shows strength. No, for a lot of African Americans, it's a throwback to days of racial strife when police and government and these other institutions were used against the community to impose its will on the community. There was the enforcement of law at the expense of order. It was an undermining of law in a way that has led to a lot of distrust that still remains today. And I think people are mindful of that. And so I don't see this sort of falling back into a 1960s frame of mind or frame of reference in terms of how we move forward. I think, in fact, that the opposite will be the case, that people will look at this sort of, you know, I am the law and order president and go, well, wait a minute, you're the guy who has not honored subpoenas. You're the guy who has upended the order of how things work. So why should we listen to you? In fact, we see you more the threat than the solution. And that, again, is going to be an interesting narrative that plays out over the course of the summer and into the fall.
You know, I saw something interesting on social media. I know I shouldn't say something like that, but the president, I am the law and order president, and you have his press secretary saying, well, these things will not happen under our watch. And then there's just a scroll of headlines, and I think it was from the Drudge Report about the looting and the burning. It's like, you are the president now. This is happening under your watch.
Right,
And people are looking at this, and they're not seeing that you're making it better. The times I've heard the phrase, and I'm here right now speaking to you from the heart of Trump country. I'm sitting here looking out my window, and I'm seeing, you know, Trump flags flying. So, but I've heard the phrase over and over again. He's pouring gasoline on it. So, Michael, I wanted to get your perspective on this because you've been doing this for years. You're an African-American man who was at one time the chairman of the Republican National Committee, which means you spent a lot of your career around white conservative Republicans. Yeah. I want to get your perspective because I know you spent a lot of time saying what you need to understand is blank. So tell me about that and why it never worked, I guess is where I'm getting at.
Why it never worked? No. Well, you know, so little noticed at the time, or at least sort of taken as a one-off by certainly a lot of the Washington press corps, which tended to be somewhat cynical during my tenure as chairman, about a number of the efforts that we were undertaking. But they had meaning, purpose, and definitely value. And one of the first speeches I gave and announcements that I made was the era of the Southern strategy is over. And everyone kind of looked at me like, okay, well, what the hell do you mean by that? And what I meant by that was, for the first time in 40 years, from 68 to 2008, the Republican Party would make an about face on its engagement. We would no longer do outreach because outreach was nothing more than a fancy term to reflect, a photo op in a nice little event where you say false platitudes and then, you know, take the photo and you leave, that we were going to do hardcore on the ground engagement. And this strategy of relying on white racist conservative votes. All right. And that's just what it was. We have to understand historically what we're talking about. When the Democratic Party made its move towards civil rights, a space that the Republican Party had occupied, the Nixon team, probably even going back to Goldwater, the thinking was inside the party, how do we begin to win and hold national elections? And as those white Southern men moved off of the Democratic Party, Nixon employed that strategy to capture that vote. And that vote has been in the basement of the Republican Party since that time. Usurped, for example, what had been sort of the libertarian slash sort of New England kind of republicanism that we had very strong fiscal conservatives and basically sort of social moderate, you know, hey, you know, we're not going to impose government on what you do in the bedroom and what you do in your home. That changed when Reagan made his bargain to win the nomination with the emerging moral majority. And for the first time, the party put a pro-life plank in its documents, in its platform. When I became a Republican, that was not a requirement. That was not a part of a belief system. The belief system was very Lincoln-esque. It was very much about individual rights and liberties, a limited government, a free market, a strong national defense that protected the homeland and ensured the rights that the Constitution provided individuals. That was where we anchored ourselves, and we wanted the economy to work in a way that everyone benefited. That's why we supported 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. That's why we supported the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, to make sure that the value of the Lincoln proposition was one that was lived out every day by every citizen. But those things began to change as that rot, in my view, set in. And that rot from the bargain that Nixon made to win a national strategy. So it was incumbent upon me as not just an African-American, but as a Republican, to move us back to that ground. So I wanted to make it very clear that this idea of this Southern strategy, we're not doing that anymore. We're not placating white nationalism and white conservative ugliness and racism. We're moving the party in a new direction. Unfortunately, after I left, they reverted.
Yeah.
My successor came in and took out all of those gains and that foundation, which we put into a coalition effort as opposed to an outreach effort. They went back to doing outreach. And then, of course, by the time 16 rolls around, a lot of those efforts had been dissipated to the point where Trump came in. And the internal battles, Charlie, were left unresolved. You know, after Reagan left, what was the movement inside the Republican Party among conservatives? Well, who's going to be the next Reagan? Mm-hmm. And everyone's kind of jockeying and sort of elbowing themselves into that position. They resented the Bushes because it was hard. It was a throwback to the kind of Republicanism I described before. And those folks who had been sitting in the basement, if you will, felt now was their chance to make the move and to fight for a new direction for the party. And here we are.
And here we are. I look back on all of this period, and of course I have a different background, but I'm going to admit though that for the last 20 years I've generally looked at most of these issues from the point of view of the police, sympathetic to the police. Mm-hmm. I don't have the I back the badge sign in my yard, but a lot of my friends have been in the police department, and I'm very sympathetic to many of the problems and the challenges they face. So a lot of what's happened in the last few years has really been kind of shocking and eye-opening. And I know you're probably rolling your eyes when I say that, but to see the videos of things that are happening, to see the cruelty, the irresponsibility, the lawlessness, has been really disconcerting. Because I'll be honest with you, I've had encounters with police officers, some of which were mildly unpleasant, as you can imagine, mildly unpleasant. I've never once felt for my safety. I never thought that I was going to be beaten or thrown.
Well, I was
going to
say, your mildly unpleasant encounter with the police is often a deadly one for me and my sons, and particularly the men in my community. And that's the difference. Your encounters with law enforcement, your encounters with the legal system, the criminal justice system, is very different one.
Yeah,
it's a very different one. You've never had to have a conversation with your sons or your nephews or young men in your community about how they have to handle themselves when they meet the police. In fact, as you were growing up and probably as you raised your kids, you would probably tell them, look, if you get in trouble, call the police.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's not the advice we give, because that actually could be begging for trouble. That actually could escalate into a worse situation.
So what advice did you give?
You work it out. If you can work it out without having to call the cops, you work it out, you know, which is why, you know, the things get handled in the community very differently. There's some things you can't avoid. Certainly when there's extreme violence and things like that, the police are going to come in. But, you know, the day-to-day stuff that happens in life, from traffic stops to, you know, other types of encounters, wind up being very different. I mean, that's the essence of the situation with Freddie Gray and Trayvon Martin and certainly Mr. Floyd, that you know, their encounters ended up being very different. And here's the thing. So even in that encounter, when you make the plea, when you do the thing you're supposed to do, you still get harmed, hurt, or killed. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, the time when, and I forget the individual's name at the moment, but, you know, a traffic stop, a simple traffic stop.
Yeah.
And the gentleman sitting there in the car with his kid in the back seat and his girlfriend, wife, in the passenger seat, and he gets shot and killed in the car. I mean, it's just, you're sitting there going, wait a minute. And this is a situation, and I believe this was the case in Texas, where the officer, do you have a weapon? Yes, I have a permit to carry. Where's your gun? It's in the glove compartment. Would you take it out? Sure. He goes to open the glove compartment and the cop shoots him. It's like, wait a minute. You did what the guy told you to do and you still wind up getting killed. So it just...
I was waiting for the NRA to come out and defend, you know, a concealed carry permit holder being shot in that particular way. And amazingly, the NRA managed not to become indignant about that.
And that's why their voice is not legitimate in these matters. And that's why the black community is not looking to the NRA to come to, and there are a lot of NRA members who are African American. We're very strong supporters of the Second Amendment in the black community, and because we know what that means for us, you know. But at the same time, when stuff like that happens, we don't have the cavalry coming in to the rescue. We don't have these national white voices coming in and saying, wait a minute, time out. They immediately side with the police and they immediately take the perspective that, as we've seen play out time and time again, well, you must have done something to provoke it. You must have been engaging in behavior that was criminal. And even in the case of George Floyd, what's one of the first thing that people, and disappointingly, even some black folks, some black conservatives out there coming up with this crazy nonsense. Oh, well, you know, he was, you know, doing something wrong. Or in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, you know, well, he was, you know, trespassing, or he was committing a crime on someone's property, when in fact that was not the case. So this immediate assumption that the African-American victim is somehow a perpetrator and therefore deserves what happens to them is a narrative that we are more than tired of at this point. And I think a lot of that's played out on our streets.
And that's what's kind of haunting about it, is because you know that in the absence of the video, what the narrative would have been, what the excuse would have been, and the number of people who would have accepted it. And so our conscience would have been untroubled. I don't know whether you've seen this viral video. JVL wrote about it in his newsletter yesterday. I think it's on Facebook, and it's a young man. I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, Giviani Jordan, who is at one of the protests, and he's on his knees, and he's, you know, they're faced off against a line of cops. There's a significant difference. It's not a tense situation at all. And he's talking to them. And let me just read a little bit of what he said. He said, "We are all people. All of you are my family. All of you are my family. I love each and every one of you. I cry at night because I feel your pain. I feel the pain. I feel the pain of black people. I feel the pain of white people. I feel the pain of innocent cops. I feel the pain." He goes on. He says, We're all scared. Black, white, cop, doesn't matter. We're living in fear. And it's really quite eloquent. He says, you're my family. I love you. I respect you. Let me get near the end here. He said, so we've got to stop judging people only on our bad days because we all have them to some degree. How are you on your good days? Do you want to make a stand? Do you want to make a change? Because if we charge you and you charge us, what is that really doing? And, you know, again, it's kind of an inspirational moment. You know how the story ends?
Oh.
Cops come over. They single him out and they arrest him.
Yeah.
He's the only one in the group they arrest. So, I mean, okay, so I'm fine. Let's condemn the looters and the violence and the people who are burning down, storefronts and churches and everything. But, you know, when you see a picture like that, you go, there's something seriously wrong. With law enforcement. And again, this is the kind of thing that you would only have if you had the videotape of it. And I really am wondering, I have played that tape over and over. I've showed it to friends and family and I've said, explain to me what the mentality is here other than we have the power. You are saying these words to us that we don't like. And we're just going to make an example of you.
So that is a command and control moment.
Yeah.
Someone within the command of that unit of officers in that situation, standing in front of that group of protesters, decided to single him out. They wanted to make an example of him. And the miscalculation in moments like that is stunning. And it is such a contrast to the officers who've chosen to do otherwise, to kneel with the protesters, for example, to march hand in hand with them as the sheriff and police chiefs have in other instances. So what we have inside the force itself is a narrative that needs to get addressed. How these officers are trained, how do they view the community that they're policing, Charlie? Look, our officers police urban centers, but live in the suburbs. So they have no idea on a day-to-day basis who the players are inside that community. Outside of whatever they get while they're on their shift, they're not there when they're off their shift. They're not there in the shops and on the streets and in the neighborhoods when kids are out doing their things and the fellas are hanging on the corner and all of that to get the vibe of that community to see what's a real threat. And what isn't? Who's a real badass and who isn't? So this idea then builds up that, you know, my perception of you is what I have of you when I'm on the job.
Yeah.
What I'm told about you in the briefing before I go out fully armored in military gear to stand in front of you to make sure you do what I tell you to do. That's not community policing.
You know, you mentioned the military gear. One of the other scary elements of this is watching these troops that are in Washington, D.C. I don't know whether you figured this out. I can't figure out who they are because they don't have any insignia. They don't have any. They don't have names on them. There are a lot of reports that they're actually bringing in folks from the Bureau of Prisons riot control units or something like
that. Yeah,
You see the picture of the Lincoln Memorial with those guys, standing there. I mean, it looked like something out of a dystopian movie.
Yep. That's Trump's America. That image is Trump's America, and it's an image that should be blown up and shared across the country because the man who stood for the ultimate freedoms in this country, who died for those freedoms, and who represented in the words that are etched in the stone in his. Second inaugural in the Gettysburg Address, that individual on the steps where Dr. King talked about an America where black and white children would be judged by the character of their nature, the content of their character, not the color of their skin, now have police rights. And their argument was, well, we didn't want any vandalizing of the Lincoln Memorial, etc. Okay. There are ways to do that besides putting 500 cops on the steps. So, again, that's the image of Trump America. That's the image that goes with the man who says, I am the law and order president. Who talks like that as president of the United States?
Well, and the contrast between we are here to serve and protect versus you mess with us and we will F you up.
Right.
So let's go back to this passion to militarize the conflict. And, you know, the Tom Cotton had an op-ed piece in the New York Times, bring in the troops. The president obviously is just lusting for bringing in the U.S. military, even if the governors don't watch. That's what I think what made yesterday so interesting is members of the military pushing back, saying, hey, you know, this is not what we do. This is not who we are. And you wonder whether or not some of Trump's inherent contempt for the military values, you know, he wants to wrap himself in the military and use them as a prop. But his constant harping on his passion for war crimes and cruelty and his misunderstanding of what honor entails, that I feel like it's kind of catching up and the people are saying, you need to speak out and you need to speak out now. We cannot have members of the U.S. military on the streets of this city with guns and bayonets aimed at, whether it's African-Americans or white protesters, aimed at Americans who are protesting.
No, I think that's exactly where the military finds itself, but they are in an unenviable position because if the president gives the order, what do they do?
Yeah. What do they do?
What do they do? And, you know, there is that part of the uniform code that talks about an unlawful order, but who gets to decide what that is and how does that work? How does that work itself down the chain and up the chain?
That's where you get resignations.
Okay, and resignations. That's exactly right, Charlie.
So let's talk about James Mattis. Does, and the question I'm going to ask at the end of this is does this matter? Does it change anything? And we know that people have been waiting for Mattis. I don't think it was a state secret that he was deeply troubled by Trump, but he'd been very reluctant to speak out. And then he issues this. Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us. We are witnessing the consequences of 3 years of this deliberate effort. We're witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership. We can unite without him, drawing on the strengths inherent in our civil society. This will not be easy, as the past few days have shown. It goes on. Then he contrasts the American ethos of unity with Nazi ideology. Instructions given by the military departments to our troops before the Normandy invasion reminded soldiers that the Nazi slogan for destroying us was divide and conquer. Our American answer is, in union, there is strength. So this is powerful stuff, but does it actually make a difference?
I think at the margins it does. I think Mattis's comments and his voice at this moment, particularly with respect to what we were just talking about, the use of force, the military's role, and the president's hankering to use them as a prop, I think is a balm for members of the military community and lets them know that there are those who are willing to rise to push back, even though they may be limited in their ability to do so inside the bubble. Someone like Mattis, who was inside, now outside, can bring that voice. So at the margins, I think it makes a difference. I think for the rank and file folks that we've seen on our television screens who are protesting across the country, it's a voice that's not necessarily heard or you know, really, I don't want to say listened to, because I don't mean it that way. Yeah. What I mean is it's not the voice that's gonna echo along the corridors of those who are marching, but it does add value to what we need to hear here inside the Washington bubble, if nothing else. What it says to the members of the GOP on the Hill, what it says to the political establishment across the country, to have someone who is still real well regarded, well respected, deeply admired, to come out and speak as we've anticipated he would, but to do so the way he did, with the force he did, I think does have some resonance in these quarters much more than it may have on the streets of, you know.
Well, no, I agree with you, and I do think it matters. It's on the margin, but it matters because this election is, a lot of it is on the margins, and I think
that's
it's part of the drip, drip, drip. You know, each individual voice doesn't necessarily, you know, tip the balance, but it is the weight of it, and it is, you know, who he is. And now Peter Weiner is a much nicer human being than I am. That's not saying a lot, but that's a bar low. But he tweeted out, "So will the right-wing media complex go after General Mattis, a four-star general, a man of unquestioned integrity and valor, a person with a great intellect as part of the quote-unquote deep state, as a traitor, as a tool of the left? Sorry, boys and girls, that dog won't hunt." The reason I say that Peter is a much nicer person than I am, I'm cynical enough to, of course they're going to go after him.
Of course they
We've seen it again. And in fact, the dog is not just going to hunt. I mean, it will be beaten to death on 1,000 talk shows. and it's happening right now. You have even Lindsey freaking Graham, who's saying, well, Mattis was just misled by the liberal media. In Trump world, no one cannot be smeared. Remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember when everybody said, well, the thing about Robert Mueller, he is, you know, there's no way they smear Bob Mueller, right? Because he is beyond, right. You know, and he's, well, yeah, look what these guys, they're completely capable of doing. Trump is already lying about Mattis, saying he fired him, you know, with the, you know, implying that he's the one who gave Mattis the mad dog. The thing is, Trump's lies are getting just dumber and dumber, but I mean, so I don't know.
Well, they're lies. I mean, yeah. they're, first off, they're lies. Second of all, you know, from Lindsey to Tom Cotton to all of these guys, look, you can line them all up and you won't even find a spine. So that's not even that's what it is. Lindsey sold his soul, so he's got to account for that. We can't waste our time trying to get into the psychology of that anymore. Just as I tell people all the time, stop thinking Trump's going to change and in this moment, at this time, he's going to come out. Yeah, no, he's not even give a rat's patootie about any of this. It's if you haven't figured out and awakened to the reality of Trump after what he did this week in front of St. John's Church, you never will. And if you waste one more second trying to, you know, give him a presidential banner to hang over his head, you are as idiotic and as lazy and as behind the times as those who continue to do that. So it's not even worth the conversation anymore because it is what it is.
Yeah. If you haven't figured this out by now, forget it.
Exactly. And the accounting is coming.
Well, let me know. I want to get to that in a moment because there are voters, I think, who are just sort of kind of rocked back. And if they think that it's a choice between Donald Trump and rioters and or AOC or, you know, Bernie Sanders, whatever. I mean, some lefty, Bill de Blasio. If they think it's that, you know, they may reluctantly go and hold their nose and vote for Donald Trump. But the thing about guys like Mattis is they represent duty, honor, country, manliness. They are grasping, you know, definitions of patriotism. This strikes me as the real vulnerability for Donald Trump. You know, people who are not afraid to wrap themselves in the flag, saying, you know, it's not your freaking flag, it's our flag. You know, it's not your patriotism, it's our patriotism. And, you know, I'll be willing to go toe to toe on, you know, who's more powerful and, you know, exercises strength more than you do. So I think we've used this phrase too much, but there's a little bit of the permission structure that a guy like Mattis and others will give a certain kind of voter to go, okay, I just can't take this anymore. So I do think it matters on the margin.
No, I agree. I think the way you laid that out is exactly correct. And that's why I said, you know, at the margin, and you made the point, and it's another correct point, that this election will be won at the margins. It will matter what those center-right, center-left, independent voters think about and how they assess this administration. You know, look, they were all okay. Yeah, I hate this, and you know, I'm not crazy about that, and I wish you wouldn't say these things. But you know, the economy is strong, and you know, things are going well, and I can't turn a blind eye to that. Oh, hell, COVID-19 smacks me. Then I lose my job or my 401k drops by 40%. And now I got social unrest. And the only thing that sticks in my head is when the president of the United States is asked about these things, his response is, I'm not responsible for any of it.
Yeah, that's a great quote. But of course, there are people who were reminded of Winston Churchill when he walked over to that church. I did think this was an interesting moment when his press secretary...
Wait a minute, excuse me. Say what? Winston who?
This is what Kaylee McInerney it says, like Churchill, we saw him inspecting the bombing damage, and it sent a powerful message of leadership to the British people. And a million voices cried out, you have to be effing kidding me. See, guys, maybe, you know, within your own bubble on some Fox News program where it's Jeanine Pirro talking to Sean Hannity, talking to Don Bagnino or whatever, you know, this is going to play. But the rest of the world is going, have you lost your minds? This is hilarious. Winston Churchill? Yeah. I remember when Winston Churchill used tear gas and rubber bullets to clear against British people to clear the way so that he could have a photo. I remember that too.
But this is the point. These folks are laughable. Their commentary, their storytelling is such a joke. And to sit there and compare Donald Trump to Winston Churchill, there is a drug that will let you do that. And clearly, she took it before she went out and spoke to people.
So. Okay, so let's just talk raw politics. I'm looking at the polls. There's brutal Fox News polls showing Trump behind in places like Arizona, Wisconsin, even Ohio. There's a Quinnipiac poll showing that Texas is in play. On the other hand, I mean, there is a mixed bag, and it looks like the president is dropping, and it has been precipitous. But as we all know, it's all about the Electoral College. So give me your sense of where we're at right now in June. We have, 150 days to the election? I just made that up. Something like that?
Yeah, somewhere around
there. I feel like 150 days that will feel like an eternity.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right, so where we are at this point is you've got the trifecta of issues that, as I noted before, that have beset the administration. COVID-19, the economy, and now civil unrest. And the thread through each of those is how not only did the president handle these things, but how he managed them and how he spoke about them, how he contextualized them for the American people, how he, in the case of COVID-19, understood the pain of the dead dying and the sick. In the case of the economy, how he recognized the importance of affirming opportunities for the small business owners to stand on their feet and to stay, to be strong on the other side of all of this. And certainly now in the case of civil unrest, whether or not you are empathetic to the plea, the cry, the fears and frustrations of countless Americans, particularly African Americans, around the continual threat by the police and the use of force by the police that results in the death of individuals. And that, I think, is why the numbers that you're seeing are beginning to shape the way they are. Donald Trump's internal numbers and even external polling, Charlie, that you've seen, I've seen, and that we've talked about show that the president was holding somewhere around 95 to 98% support among Republicans, just writ that banner large, Republicans, didn't break down the conservatives, Republicans. You know what that number is today? 84%. So that's what's shaken them more than anything else. Is the fact that that number of enthusiasm and support inside the rank and file is shrinking. Why? Because under scenario number one, they're now realizing that they're sick and they've lost people. And there doesn't seem to be a mechanism in place to address that, whether it's testing protocols, et cetera. The economy, their business, small businesses are gone. Their 401ks took a 30%, 40% hit. And you know, they lost their job, or a family member did. And now in the civil unrest, they're watching their children go out and protest and say to them, "Mom, Dad, you know this isn't right."
Yeah,
that's and powerful. So there are these dynamics now that even in the sheltered world of republicanism, where it starts to break down, and why you see the president lashing out. He's going to grab at straws. He's going to throw spaghetti against the wall. He's going to try to figure out the magic formula to pull, not just pull that vote back, but to try to lock it in. That walk across Lafayette Park was not for your consumption, Charlie. It wasn't for mine. It was for that base that was starting to erode. It was to reassert and shore up that base to come back. Don't leave me now. Come on now. I'm the law and order guy. Remember, I'm the one who's told you I can fix this. That's why I am your law and order president.
Well, the flaw there, of course, is that base is just not large enough to win the election. He still does need those margin. And your point about the 84%, that may seem like a very high number, but
it's not.
16% of Republicans, and if you have 16% of Republicans who don't vote for Donald Trump, he's not going to win re-election. Those will be the voters. And I just don't think that anything he's doing right now is going to be getting those voters back.
I agree with you, and that is where the narrative is going, because the reality of it is, and I've always said this, that you know everyone starts talking about he's got 38% support. Well, okay, fine, but the reality of we're talking about a small number of the population, and in terms of the GOP, and so you've got to build out, you've got to find another way to get to that 270 in the Electoral College. And if you're now behind, if you're tied in Texas, which the Fox poll shows, if you're behind in Wisconsin, and you're behind in Michigan, and you're behind in Pennsylvania, okay, so where do you go if you're behind in three of the states that gave you the 78,000 votes you needed to win? Remember, you only won by 78,000 votes. So if you take away one of those states, where does he go to make it up? And if you're tied in Texas, of all places, what does that tell you about those other states like Florida, Ohio, Arizona, etc.?
Yeah, North Carolina, even Georgia. Well, here's a dazzling detail out of my home state of Wisconsin. Suburban women are going 64% for Biden versus 29% for Trump. 64-29. Look, you've spent years looking at these numbers. Those are just like mind-blowing numbers.
Well, you know, I'm gonna play a little bit of devil's advocate skeptic here. I'm a little bit of a skeptic. I remember what happened in 2016.
We all do.
I saw what happened in 2018. And what is little talked about or noticed is that you still had suburban white women vote for the Republican/Trump candidate by 49% in 2018. So I get it and I understand it. And maybe that curve has we've arrived at that curve and we're now on the other side of it where that's a real number. But I'm still not convinced of where the white female suburban vote is. I don't know if that's a vote I can trust yet in this election to be against Trump by those margins on election day.
No, I think everybody ought to be skeptical and understand, you know, how odd this election is. There was one survey that I saw somewhere, I don't have it in front of me, where I think it was something like only 1% of voters said that they thought there was a possibility they would change their minds between now and November. So anybody that thinks this is going to be just a blowout election one way or another, I think is somewhat naive. Yeah. Michael Steele, thank you so much for coming back on the boat.
Thank you.
We really appreciate having you.
Can I just say thank you for your voice out here, Charlie? I mean, you're one of the noted conservative voices, and to take the principled positions to advocate for what I would call Lincoln-esque Republicanism, a lot of us really appreciate it, man. Just keep it going.
Well, thank you so much. I really, really do appreciate that. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.